Welcome to DC Specialcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Paul Ken. This podcast is an exploration of DC's special comics of the Bronze Age, which included such titles as the aptly named DC Special and DC Special Series, but also DC Superstars, Super DC Giant, Four-Star Superhero Spectacular, and others. If you've read any of these comics, you know that they varied wildly in content, quality, and even format. They featured every possible genre of the comics industry at the time. Today, I'm very excited because I'm joined by my new pal, Brento3000, all the way from Australia. And the future, no doubt. It's the next day that I'm talking to him. Brent is one of the hosts of the podcast Tomorrow's Heroes Today, focused on the Three Boot Legion. Brent, welcome to DC Specialcast.
Thanks, Paul. It's great to be here. And yes, it is a day ahead here in Melbourne, Australia. It's also winter, so it's freezing today. It's nice to be here and talking about this fun topic.
Well, great. And that topic is DC Special Series number 10, Secret Origins of the Superheroes, with origins for Black Canary, Dr. Fate, and everybody's favorite new god, Light Ray. Now, what's interesting is this was actually the victor in our recent Patreon poll with, I think it was 29% of the vote. So I reached out to Brent, who had asked about this issue previously, and so we pulled together. Brent, why don't you tell us your secret origins with comics? How good was the distribution of American comics in Australia in the 1970s? Why did you ask for this issue?
Yeah, look, it wasn't very good at all, Paul, to tell you the truth. I have a bit of a funny history with comics. I also lived in the UK in the mid-70s. So I'd come across American comic books in the UK and had some early experiences with those, which included the Super Friends comics. And I can distinctly remember reading a Superman and the Metal Man comic as a kid. But I think the real intro sort of came when I got back to Melbourne in 1977, 78 and discovered Australian reprint comics in our newsagents, as we call them here. They were black and white reprints of Marvel and DC comics. They were usually about a year and a half behind the US. So they were sort of coming out a bit later, but they were also quite random. So a couple that I used to read were Mighty Comic and Superhero Album. They had color covers and everything inside was black and white, which led to lots of interesting things. I was a big Legion of Superheroes fan, always have been, and I had no idea what color most of the characters' costumes were because and so I didn't know that Cosmic Boy had a pink costume for years. Quite a wild cover. Yeah, it was interesting. And they would often crop the covers and do interesting things. And they were slightly wider than the US format as well. And so sometimes the artists would embellish the covers by sort of extending the artwork to the sides, which often wasn't very good quality, which was kind of funny. Recolor them. They did all sorts of interesting things. You know, there's an interesting website called Oz Reprints. You can look these up on, but it's a bit hard to search for stories. And I think I read some of these stories. I certainly had a copy of the Immortal Dr. Fate number one, which reprinted the Dr. Fate story from this issue. And I think I read the Light Ray story as well, but I wasn't able to track down in my research exactly where that might have been. These comics then were not very durable. The covers usually fell off. I don't have any of them anymore. I switched to color comics direct from the US in about 1983. That's kind of when I got into those. And it was interestingly, Roy Thomas's All-Star Squadron, which introduced the Infinity Inc. team that got me into buying US comics.
Oh, wow.
I haven't looked back. My Legion collecting started a little bit later when I discovered the Baxter series.
That's a great story. Before we get too much farther, we want to take a moment to thank our sponsors. This episode of DC Specialcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 40% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. So I picked Black Canary, the Bird of Prey trade paperback. So this is actually, I think, an exact reprint of the Black Canary archives that came out in the early 2000s. This came out around the time of the Birds of Prey movie. She's appeared on TV and movies, and now Black Canary stars in this title, collecting the best of her classic adventures from the Golden to the Bronze Age. These tales guest star Johnny Thunder, Starman, and more. Collect stories from Adventure Comics 399 and 418 to 419, Brave and the Bold 61, 62, that's the one with Starman, Flash Comics 86 to 88 and 90 to 104, DC Special number 3, and Comic Cavalcade number 25. Ironically, Mike's Amazing World said that the Black Canary origin in this comic is in here, but I checked it out on the digital version. I don't have this. I have the archive. I don't have this. And it's not in the archive, and it's not in the digital version of this that's on DC Universe. We'll talk about where the stories are reprinted later, but I think there's a slight error at Mike's on this one.
Was this the first reference, the story, the Black Canary story we're going to look at today? A canary is a bird of prey. Is this the first reference to birds of prey?
I think it might be. I don't know. She had a lot of bird motif, and it's been a while since I read that archive, the stories from the 40s. I'd have to go back and look. But I mean, she didn't have a whole lot of solo stories. It may very well have been that somebody used that term. It feels that way, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I was quite surprised. I didn't realize it went back that far. Yeah, it's cool.
So, Brent, despite the fact that I don't think In Stock Trades delivers to Australia, did you have a recommendation?
It's funny that delivery to Australia is a bit of a problem, full stop at the moment. It's very expensive to ship to Australia. So I've kind of given up on that for a while. Yes, I did bring a recommendation. So the book I've chosen is one that I will order. It's Dr. Fate by JMD Mateus, trade paperback. This book is fantastic value on In-Stock Trades at $35.99, and it has 776 pages of Dr. Fate, including the miniseries from 1987, Dr. Fate Volume 2, issues 1 to 24, and it also includes Dr. Fate Annual 1. I love Dr. Fate. I think this is a fantastic collection to bring together. I've been trying to source the Sean McManus and DeMatteis issues, and I've got about a third of them. But yeah, fantastic. So yeah, that's the one I recommend.
All right, so now let's get into the issue. DC Special Series number 10, Secret Origins of Superheroes, was on sale, according to Mike's Amazing World, on January 31st, 1978. Its cover date is just 1978. It's one of these ones, didn't have a month on it. Cover price 60 cents. We got 48 pages, and it was edited by E. Nielsen Bridwell. In terms of Wayne's special investments, it's pretty simple. You can get a lower grade copy online, at least in the US, $5 or less, pretty much. But a nicer one, you probably need to spend closer to $10. As I said before, it's a little hard to track these down at a show because it's a crapshoot as to whether a dealer brings them. But what are you going to do? So, Brent, do you have a physical copy of this comic?
No, I do not. And this is an era that's really hard to source. There were a very small number of comic book shops. I hadn't discovered them at that age. So no, I never got hold of one, and I haven't managed to source them as back issues here in Australia. But I did have a copy of Immortal Dr. Fate. I had that mini series number one, which reprinted this Dr. Fate story. I feel like I read a Light Ray story in one of the Australian Murray Comics or Planet Comics reprints, but I'm not sure, and I haven't been able to track that down.
Unfortunately, this issue is also not on DC Universe Infinite, but one of the stories is available as part of a collected edition, which you can read on DC Universe Infinite. I'll mention that later when we get to it. For historical context, the biggest DC comic published in January 1978, in many ways, was All New Collector's Edition C56. That's, of course, the classic Superman versus Muhammad Ali. And it was a pretty big month, actually, for DC. Batman Family number 17, which my podcasting partner, Sean M. Myers, and I covered in 2023 on Batman Family Reunion, was the first dollar comic of that series. World's Finest 250 with the epic Reality War story. And the Super Friends number 11, which holds a fond place in my heart because I actually covered this with Rob on For All Mankind way back in 2020. That was my first ever podcast. So for Marvel, when I looked, I saw a lot of good books, but no real key books except for Spider-Woman number 1. But I do have to give a shout out to the cover of John Carter, Warlord of Mars number 11 by Dave Cockrum. Va-va-boom, as they say. Dejah Thoris never looked better. Either use your imagination or check out Mike's Amazing World to check that out. So Brent, you mentioned that you weren't collecting quite yet, but do you look through this, any favorites or things that you've seen that you've read or enjoyed at this time?
Well, I certainly remember the Superman Muhammad Ali Treasury. They were available in newsagents in
Oh, really?
Australia. And
Interesting.
I think I had some of them from memory. So I think I had the Batman Hulk and the Spider-Man Superman one. And I had I think the Amazing World of Superman. Is that one of them? Yeah, I had some of those. I was mostly reading these Australian reprints, and one that I can remember that would have been on the shelf at that time was one called Superheroes Album Number 8 from Murray Comics. And it had a whole lot of Superboy and the Legion stories in it. And it's got the cover, which is sort of Brainiac 5 laughing at some Legionnaires floating in space. Obviously, it's a sort of, I think, of the era where he went a bit crazy. So
I mean, this is cool. Brent sent me ahead of time a link to this usreprints.net website, and it's cool because This is like a trade paperback. By my count, there are 7 issues of the Legion of Superheroes reprinted in this.
100 pages.
Yeah, it's cool. I should say 6 Legion of Superheroes and a Challengers of the Unknown for some reason. But
Page count. Page count, I think.
so I'll include a link to this in case anybody wants to do a little exploring on Australian reprints. I thought that was neat. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, good fun.
And then finally, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that this comic was also covered on Ryan Daley's Secret Origins, the Redux version, episode 1 from 2020. If you want to hear that show, I'll include a link in the show notes. I purposely did not go back and re-listen to that show before recording, so hopefully you'll get a fresh take from Brent and from me. So let's move on. Brent, do you want to describe the cover for our listeners and give us your thoughts?
Absolutely. So the cover's got our logo on it, Secret Origins of Superheroes. As you sort of said, these are specials sort of in that annual format. And this one has the three origins. So on the cover, we've got Light Ray bursting through with a rather pained expression on his face. We've got Dr. Fate casting some magic, and we've got Black Canary sort of, I guess, surprised by the appearance of Light Ray. I really love the composition by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez,
That is
probably his
his
name.
name.
I think it's fantastic. I really like the way he's brought together three quite random characters, really. They don't have a lot of connection. I guess Dr. Fate and Black Canary have some connection through the JSA, but I really like just little things like the fact that Dr. Fate and Black Canary's feet are resting on the bottom of the cover. And it's lined up perfectly, just so clever. Really like having Light Ray in the middle. Interestingly, Light Ray is not emerging from a boom tube, but it seems to be some sort of magical portal or something that Dr. Fate's conjured up. But I did like to see what almost looks like Kirby crackle around Light Ray, which I thought was kind of fun. Look, it's beautiful artistically. Always great to see Garcia Lopez's work. As a teacher, I'm a primary school teacher here in Australia. I really like the fact that he's put his lowercase letters between the lines that he's drawn on the bottom of the page, and his uppercase letters between the other lines, which is exactly what he's telling students to do. Great teaching there by Garcia Lopez. I really like the rewording of the titles, which we'll get to in a minute with the table of contents. I think these are really catchy, and if I'd seen this book on the shelf, I would have picked it up. I look at Light Ray and I would have looked at him then going, who is this character? And I'd be really keen to find out. I love the word Genesis in his little The Strange Genesis of Light Ray. I think that's really clever. You know a bit about them already from the text that's on the page, you know, the untold mysteries of Dr. Fate, and you know, and each one's got a slightly different font for their name as well. Yeah, I really liked it. Did you like this cover?
I loved it. It's gorgeous. You know, obviously, big fan of Garcia Lopez. I never thought a whole lot one way or another about Light Ray, to be honest with you, but always liked Dr. Fate, always liked Black Canary. And this is the copy that I picked up when I was, I guess I
Wow.
would have been 12 or 13 years old.
I did a bit of research around Light Ray, and this sits between issue 15 and 16 of Return of the New Gods. So it's fairly deep into that run, which wasn't a very long run.
Yeah, there was the first issue special, which I don't think I had, but then when they started it back up with number 12 or 13, whatever that was, I did buy that. Really didn't know what was going on.
I was surprised Light Ray was quite a major character in that. You know, he appears quite a bit. When we talk about his story, we can talk about that a bit more. But he was definitely a key player, which surprised me as well, because when I think New Gods, he's not the first one that comes to mind.
No, he's not. But go back and read some of the older ones. Orion was such the big star. But the ones that are popular today, Mr. Miracle and Big Bart, I mean, Mr. Miracle had his own title, of course. So it's just interesting to see how things change over time. But yeah, he's kind of an afterthought now. This book also, as a lot of these specials do, have a table of contents. And it's really neat. It's got all three of our heroes staring into Dr. Fate's crystal ball with the contents of the issue. It's not signed. And Mike's Amazing World does not have an attribution, but the Grand Comics database at comics.org does attribute it to Don Newton and Frank Chiaramonte, which makes sense because they did the Light Ray feature, but I did not immediately recognize it as Newton. As I was saying to Brett before we started recording, I kind of see Newton in Light Ray, but less of Newton in Black Canary, and Dr. Fate's is a little more on the generic side. Anyway, it's a good composition for a table of contents because here they are. It says, you know, they got the three stories telling you what page they're on and stuff like that. So it's a cool thing. And I always like the table of contents. They're just fun. How about you? What do you think of the table of contents, Brett?
I was wondering who'd drawn it. I'd wondered if it was Dylan. Obviously, it's not. It reminded me very much of some of those JLA style books where they had chapters, and even the way the contents are set up really looks like one of those JLA, JSA crossovers or something like that. What sort of struck me about it is that origins, origins, origins. Like, we've got the word origin on the page four times, I think it is. I think they're making it clear we're going to find out the backstories of these characters.
A funny story about that. When I was a kid, I had never heard the word origin used in a sentence out loud, right? I used to say origin or something like that. And the other one was Arkham Asylum. Even those two words, they're just not ones that you used in your everyday school life, right?
Yep.
So it's another example of my reading ability being ahead of my conversational language. So I thought that was fun.
Absolutely. And yeah, I see that a lot with students, actually. And I would have to attribute comics to my larger vocabulary. There's certainly words come up in comic books that I never would have come across in real life.
Absolutely.
I like the lighting in this as well. Like, obviously, the magical crystal balls throwing off some light. Considering, you know, these were four color comics, has thrown the light onto Dr. Fate and Black Canary's face and Light Ray's face. I think it's well done.
Of course, I will post the cover, the table of contents, several other pages on the gallery page for DC Special Cast at fireandwaterpodcast.com. Brent, you want to read the summary for the first story?
Yeah, so the first story is called This Immortal Destiny. It's an eight-page story about Dr. Fate, written by Paul Levitz, penciled by Joe Staton, and inked by Michael Netzer. I didn't really know who Michael Netzer was till much later. I sort of came across Joe Staton with his All-Star Comics, mm-hmm. Justice Society stories, and Green Lantern. So I knew him quite well. But Michael Netzer is an absolute favorite of mine. I love one of his Legion stories, which is called Mon-El's One-Man War. I don't know if you know that story, but it's Mon-El against the whole Kund invasion fleet.
I do recall that now. Yeah.
These amazing spaceships in it with lots and lots of perspective and lots of great sort of flyby scenes with Mon-El flying. I don't think Mon-El's ever looked better. This story has been reprinted, as I've mentioned, in Immortal Dr. Fate number one in 1985, which unfortunately is not available digitally. The synopsis basically is Inza Nelson is wistfully writing in her diary. She recounts how her husband Kent, accompanied by his archaeologist father, heads to an Egyptian tomb at the tender age of 12. But when Kent discovered the tomb of Nabu, a gas was released that killed his father. Nabu took control of Kent, first banishing grief from the boy with magic and then artificially aging him up to being an adult. Turns out Kent was destined to be an agent of the Lords of Order. Cue the montage of explanation of the eternal struggle between the Lords of Order and chaos. Nabu presented Kent with the Helmet of Fate, and when he dons it, Kent's personality is subsumed and he becomes something else. Inza completes her entry by wishing for more time with Kent the man and less time with Dr. Fate. The end.
So what did you think of this? You said you read it back in the day in Immortal Dr.
I did. And, well, yeah, probably I read it in the 1985 version, actually. But I did. I love this story. I really like the fact that it's told from the perspective of Inza. I think that's fantastic. It's interestingly following up only a couple of years after a first issue special origin of Dr. Fate, which also heavily features Inza. And that one was drawn by Marty Pascoe and Walt Simonson and is also a fantastic story. Both of them really lent into developing Inza as a character. And I think that's what I really liked about this as well. Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if you agree, but I think back in these days, many of the wives or partners were sort of left waiting for the superheroes to come back when they went off on an adventure. And they didn't have a lot to do in many of the stories. They were just kind of like a, I hate to say, a bit of a sort of a handbag. So if you think of ones like Joan Garrick or Jean Loring or Iris West, they were kind of always just left a bit on the side. Some sort of surpassed this, like Lois Lane or Sue Dibney, that sort of got a bit of something to do in story. But it was nice to see Inza developed. You know, she had feelings about this and she was not happy with it. I really like that. I think this was a dawn of an era of deeper storytelling. And I think that carries this story really well. You know, obviously the Lords of Order and Chaos bits worth exploring and understanding, and sort of the trickery of Naboo as well.
I second everything you said. That first issue special is kind of a running joke on the network since several people have covered it. Shag has covered it in like three different shows. And some of this, all the Lords of Order and stuff, that's where that came from, right? So that some of this is taken from that and adapted from that story. Having Inza narrate it and get into her feelings is really neat. And when you think about it, that book that you recommended, The Dr. Fate by J.M. DeMatteis, the twist that he brought in that, you know, Dr. Fate was supposed to be both Inza and Kent, you know, made that really interesting and a little bit more tragic, I thought. But yeah, so what do you think of the art? You mentioned you really like
on that. I love it. I think Dr. Fate's helmet has never looked better, especially on that last page. I think the Lords of Order and Chaos look great. I think Naboo in both his forms looks terrific. I can't help but thinking it's Netza's inking that's really lifting the art.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, Staten is known as being a little more cartoony, and it's not the match that I would think of in my head, given their sort of somewhat different styles. You can see Joe Staten in the figure work and the faces, like even Inza on the splash page and in the top of the next page where she's holding face in her hands. But then, like, I agree with you, the scenes of the Lords of Order and Chaos, I think pretty heavily influenced by the inker too. The only thing I didn't love was if you look on page three, the bottom of page three, little Kent, they mentioned, make a point three times to say that he's 12 years old, but he looks like he's four on that.
Yes.
But you know, one of the things that always bothered me about Dr. Fate is they play into it now with Naboo being very much a control freak and not always a character we want to root for. But he takes this boy, he ages him up, he sort of wipes out all the emotion that he had about the death of his father. I guess at the time that was felt, oh, you don't want to get the boy to be feeling guilty because he unleashed this gas that killed his father. But by the same token, you read it with a modern eye, and it feels a bit off. I don't know. That's just my two cents. I don't know if you got that as you were rereading.
Look, I agree. And I think, got to remember, this is probably coming on the tail of, I don't know where it sits in relation to Captain Marvel, Shazam as well. That idea of aging up a boy to a man possibly had been explored before.
I mean, that is part of the original story, just to be fair.
Yeah. Right?
I don't know. I mean, I've seen this story before. I think you're right. The main part that makes this interesting and different is Inza's narration and how she portrays and what her thoughts are of all these occurrences. But that brings a question. So here's your question for tonight.
Yeah.
How was Kent ever, quote, normal enough to date Inza and end up getting married to her?
I'm going to put it down to his half-face helmet. Must have met her while he was using the half helmet.
Okay, the half helmet where he wasn't so much Naboo. You know, it's not like he's in the movie big or anything. It's not like he talks or ever acts like a child. He always acts like an adult, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I've never had that thought before about Dr. Fate, but it struck me as I was reading this because Inza's narration was so much part of it.
The other thing interesting in the story was that they linked her aging to his not aging. And his, they waved it away with magic. And hers, they're just kind of saying, well, I've been near him all the time. And so right. It's kind of like, it was interesting that DC were already trying to sort of arrest the ages of these JSA heroes to keep them in the DC.
Oh, we'll talk about that some more when we get to Black Canary.
Oh, yeah. Well,
with magic, you can buy it. Right.
I personally think it's one of the recent errors that DC's made in rewriting their timelines, actually, because I think that they sort of went down this multiverse path that we're going to bring the multiverse back and we're going to have an Earth 2, and then they're not using it. They're not actually using it as Earth 2 and putting the JSA on it. They're actually leaving them on Earth 1, which I love for DC. I love, you know, Jay Garrick with Wally West, and, you know, I love that stuff. I think they're still struggling with this timeline problem, clearly. The other thing I noticed, I don't know if you noticed, was the creator credits was done in a really interesting way on the first page for this, done on a scroll. And I'm guessing that NASA has done it, not the letterer, but I'm not sure. The only reason I say that is his own name is written in a really distorted way. And it says Mike NASA, not Mike Netza. And, you know, this is one of the things about him. His name changes a bit.
I haven't done a profile on him. He's an interesting character. I do know that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I like this story. I thought this is one of the strong stories in this book.
I also enjoyed it. I had not read the first issue special at the time, so I remember enjoying this. I do think, read them both now, that the first issue special has more pages in it, more time to breathe and so forth. I do think that's a little bit better story, but the big role that Inza plays in this gives this a little distinctiveness, even though it's essentially the same story.
Yep.
All right. So before we go on, I do have to mention real quick a couple ads. We did get a Hostess Cupcake ad right before the end of the Dr. Fate story. It's the big fall. It's the one where Superman saves a group of kids in an elevator, smashes the elevator up back through the roof of the building, and then tosses them some Hostess Cupcakes so they don't get upset. the opposite page of that, there is an ad, a great ad for the $2 comics, The Batman Family and The World's Finest that I mentioned earlier. Terrific ad.
Love it. I love some of these old ads in these books. Half the fun of reading them.
All right, let's move on to our second story starring Light Ray, titled This Light Aborning. 14 pages of all three of these characters. Light Ray gets the longest story, 14 pages, written by Jerry Conway with art by Don Newton and Frank Chiaramonte. And this one has been reprinted in New Gods by Jerry Conway from 2020. So that was a hardcover, also available digitally on DC Universe Infinite. So you can read this story digitally if you'd like, but it hasn't been reprinted in another comic book, just in that one collection, as far as I know. It's probably in that Volume 2 Omnibus 2 that has all Jerry Conway's story in it, but I didn't check. So it's a beautiful day in New Genesis, and Light Ray's out for a morning fly. He happens upon a few kids playing near a crater, a remnant of the war with Apocalypse. Of course, he saves one of them from falling into the pit. Light Ray decides to sit down with the kids and tell them his story. He recounts how, as a young boy, originally named Solas, he was there when Orion was introduced to New Genesis as part of the peace treaty with Darkseid. He and Metron befriended Orion. The boys hung out together all the time, the happy-go-lucky Solas, the rough-and-tumble Orion, and the serious scholar Metron. One day, the boys were exploring a crater, just like the one these other kids were. On a dare from Metron, Orion and Solas climbed down and discovered a secret invasion force from Apocalypse. Solas fell and was blasted by a strange ray and knocked unconscious. Orion charged, but was quickly subdued. Meanwhile, Metron was wondering what they were doing for so long, so he climbed down and saw that the boys had been captured. Metron had sent a message to Highfather, though, and distracted the enemies long enough until a rescue force arrived. The boys were okay, but Solas was in a coma. Feeling guilty, Metron worked night and day to cure Solas. He was eventually successful, but when Solas woke up, he found he had solar powers. Highfather encouraged him to select a new name, which of course became Light Ray. His tale concluded, Light Ray asked the kids if they still want to explore this dangerous crater. They decline, and as they walk away, Light Ray promises to share some more lighthearted tales with them in the future. The end. So what'd you think about this one? You've got Don Newton here.
I love Don Newton. I discovered Don Newton reading Infinity Inc., a bit of a gateway for me into comics.
The last things he worked on.
Exactly. So it was only Infinity Inc. issue 11 to 13, and only one of those was a full issue. So look, I love the Don Newton art in this. I think in contrast to your comments about Joe Staton, I think his children look like children.
Yes.
And I really like that in comics. I think often, you know, because I read a lot of Superboy and the Legion, Superboy is often not portrayed as a boy or a teenager. He's often portrayed as a young man. But when they get it right, they get it right. So I think he does a really good job with that. Look, I love his shadow work. I think the story is really easy to follow. I really like the story. I think the child listener, it's kind of like really puts the reader of the comic in the audience position.
You could have been sitting right on Light Ray's knee, just like that girl there.
Exactly. Yeah. I was quite surprised by the way that Metron was portrayed. I probably, even if I did read this back in the day, wouldn't have recognized who Metron was by that. I think I was very much used to his costumed appearance. Found that really interesting. Yeah, I was also interested in the friendship with Orion. I hadn't realized. My introduction to the New Gods was more through the JLA-JSA crossover with the New Gods, three-parter that was drawn by Dylan and then Perez. Yeah, I guess the friendship wasn't portrayed so much in the era post that JLA-JSA crossover. I think it was more about Orion and Mr. Miracle and Big Barter, as you're saying, and Dark. Yeah, I was surprised by that, but I like it.
This is, like you said, smack dab in the middle of Jerry Conway's run. He's really sort of integrating in that, and he's playing up the relationship of the characters. And that's typical Jerry Conway type stuff, right? He's bringing that Marvel style over to DC at this time. He's been at DC maybe a year by now, and he's really trying to make the interpersonal relationships more interesting. So I think that's part of it. The weirdest part for me was that Light Ray, out of his 14 pages, is unconscious for four or five of them. It's really all about Metron then, because Metron sneaks down, Metron saves them, Metron is then working on the cure for Solas. So I found that interesting. So it's really more of of both of them, right? We don't get Metron's origin, like how he invented the chair or anything like that. But it is interesting that it's about the three boys, which I guess makes sense if Light Ray is telling this story to the young children that he doesn't want falling down the other crater. So I don't know. I just think it's kind of neat.
It is a cautionary tale. It's very focused on the cautionary tale of don't be reckless. It's very interesting, the reprint of this. You mentioned the hardcover edition. The blacks are much blacker, and the recoloring, the The whole thing is, it looks quite different in the reprint. There's a really nice scene where the boys are climbing down into the crater, and Orion is kind of hard to pick out in the shadow at the bottom in the middle panel. But when you see that in the reprint, it's really clear and kind of pops.
I think you're right. It's hard to see some of them because, like, is that light ray or
One of the bottom.
black? The one on the bottom, he has a black shirt. I don't know if that's colored differently in the
No,
re. I
it's
don't.
still black, but the outlining of that character's, there's more white around it, so you can actually see.
Got it.
But yeah, it's just different. It's
Yeah.
always interesting to see how they do that. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, no, I really liked it. I like that it's tied into the greater New Gods story. And he says, I was there when Orion showed up. You know, there weren't a lot of kids. I was one of his friends. We did stuff together. And Metron is like goading them on, which I thought was interesting. That's why he felt guilty later, because th then he wouldn't climb down. He's like, oh, no, climbing makes me ill. I love that part. It turns out that these invaders were really the bomb from Apocalypse that created the crater, had some sort of residual energy that turned the nearby residents of New Genesis into followers of Darkseid. Wow. I get a big crater and maybe inserting some spies in there, but I guess this gave Darkseid plausible deniability that he was honoring the truce treaty.
It's a bit like the stories of the Japanese soldiers after World War II who sort of remained stranded on some of the
Yeah, still thought the war
Pacific
was going on.
islands, and they were still fighting the war. And there's a very famous story of one of them, I don't know, 15 years later, and someone has to explain to him, no, the war finished. It's like.
So I had a couple other notes. I did think it was ironic that Orion was somewhat of a cautious one in this, and Lightray was more, you know, come on, let's go, let's do it. More risk-taking, given how, I don't know, boisterous and wild and stuff Orion is usually portrayed, especially nowadays, but even in the as an adult in the New Gods series at the time. So I thought that was interesting.
With their friendship, Paul, that I've seen this happen in classes, that you'll have a class, you'll be in the middle of the school year, and suddenly a new student will enroll. And suddenly there's always that kid that just wants to be the new kid's friend. You know, it's like, oh, I'll be his friend. Where Solace is just kind of like, yeah, I'm gonna look after the new kid. And I'm thinking in the back of my mind, you don't know what you're in for. That's Orion. It's like,
And the other thing you kind of mentioned is Metron's portrayal of his personalities. He's portrayed with much more of a heart than he's portrayed with today. Today he's portrayed, you know, robotic, Vulcan-like, as opposed to a regular person who I guess hadn't been influenced by his chair at this point.
yeah.
And then my last note was that there's an odd panel on the last page, page 14 of the story. Light Ray sort of levitates out of his bed after he's woken up from being in a coma for a period of time. And Highfather takes him and he's flying and swinging through the air. And it really looks awkward
Yeah.
how the boy is sort of flying. All he's got his on is his underwear, and Highfather's got him by the wrist. And I don't know whether he's catching him from like flying away or swinging him out or what, but it was just kind of an odd looking panel to me. I wasn't quite sure what's going on there.
I liked that. I thought it showed that he was not in control. And there is a bit of a trailing sort of light effect down to the left panel, and similarly in the bed when he's levitating. So I guess he was zooming off
He's out of
somewhere.
control and Highfather caught him.
Yeah.
I mean, I've read a lot of New Gods stories now, and I went back and I have the Jack Kirby New Gods omnibus, and I read those. But one of the interesting thing that I never thought about before, but it's in the caption right on the splash page. Of all the New Gods, he's the only one that possesses what mortals might deem a superpower. So he's got these light powers. And I was thinking, you know, Mr. Miracle doesn't, and Barda doesn't, and Highfather's kind of like Odin, but he doesn't shoot lightning bolts or anything. So I was like, huh, it never occurred to me that they didn't have powers. Am I reading that wrong? Never.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you'd say that Darkseid's henchmen are all kind of a bit unique,
Yeah.
and so are Highfather's people. Like, they're all a bit unique, but yeah, I guess they're all just kind of strong or kind of
Right.
evil, kind of good, or kind of good at escaping, or yes.
Yeah, they don't fly. I mean, Orion has that cycle thing, and Mr. Miracle's got his discs that he goes on. So, I mean, is Light Ray the only one who can fly? I guess, you know, I don't know. It hadn't occurred to me before. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, me too.
Anything else on this?
Not really on this one. Enjoyable story.
Yeah, great. Great story. Best art. I mean, the art in general in this comic is very good, all three stories. So the last one is starring Black Canary, titled, of course, The Canary is a Bird of Prey, as Brent alluded to earlier. 12 pagers, again written by Jerry Conway, this time penciled by Mike Vosburgh and inked by Terry Austin. And as far as I can find, it's never been reprinted. So we open in medias res as the Black Canary takes down a crook. Her boyfriend, Green Arrow, pops out of a window, is watching her in the wings, asks, "Hey, have you ever regretted not living a normal life?" Which is a reasonable question, I guess, but it seems like a weird time to ask it. Anyway, the question does get Dinah musing. She thinks back to her time as a young girl on Earth 2. Her police officer dad, Richard, was pushing her from a very young age to be the best she could be, physically and mentally. All Dinah wanted was to make him proud and become a cop like him, which was easier said than done for a woman back in the day. Part of Dinah's training also included real-life action with her dad and his partner, young Larry Lance. Dinah continues to prove herself, even saving their lives. She eventually falls in love with Larry. But one night, they come home and see that Richard has died of a heart attack. He had just received notification that Dinah's application to the police academy was rejected because they had no more spots for women. Inspired by mystery men like Batman and Green Lantern, Dinah decides to fight crime a different way. Apparently giving up her dream of becoming a police officer, she instead opens a flower shop. But by night, she goes out as the Black Canary. She marries Larry and even joins the legendary Justice Society of America. But there was no happy ending there. During an adventure with the JSA and JLA, the cosmic being named Aquarius kills Larry. That same exchange also grants Dinah the power of her cosmic cry. Needing a new start on life, Dinah moves to Earth 1 and eventually began a new relationship with Green Arrow. We close with Dinah realizing she has no regrets, that despite the tragedies she has endured, her life is in fact her own. The end. So, Brant, what's your reactions to this story?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. It's sort of a recap of JLA 73 and 74. It's sort of talking about how she got to Earth One and joined the JLA. I guess neither of these stories are my era of Black Canary. I read JLA 220, which vamps this whole origin story. We'll talk about that in a minute in a very different direction. So I found all this a bit odd. Like I knew there was an Earth Two Black Canary. That was the daughter of a policeman. So, look, I think it's a pretty straightforward story. You're going to talk a bit about the artist, but I didn't love the art, I have to be honest. We've talked about the portrayals of children in the other two stories. I do not like the portrayal of Dinah as a young girl here. I think it's very odd looking.
It is odd looking, yeah.
All the early Black Canary stories, she's very sexualized. And that splash page scene of her leaning up a girl against a wall in a spotlight, I'm kind of like, is this necessary? Like, really? 1978, like it's.
Yeah, definitely the little cheesecake going
I think Inza Nelson would have had a thing or two to say to her about her role in relationships. You know, even Green Arrow's comments to her early on, they're quite. I think all of this was redressed the Longbow Hunters, where she became her own woman in lots of ways after tragic events. Yeah, I don't know. I love Terry Austin. Not so sure about the figure work that he's having to ink. Like the story, I didn't love this one. Interesting the use of two different Black Canary logos. I don't know if you noticed that.
I did know. I was going to ask what you thought about that, because and I'll describe it for the. Well, why don't you describe it for the listeners?
The first one is just the words black and canary in capital letters in very sort of bold font. And the word black is in black font and canary in white. The second one is sort of the credits box. I think this was used in another Terry Austin.
Well, it was actually used in the Alex Toth story. Appeared in two consecutive issues of Adventure Comics. That is in that trade paperback and the archives. The last story in the archives is from the early 70s, probably a couple of years before this. That logo is used in those stories, and I recognize that immediately because I do have a soft spot for those stories. They're, I mean, Alex Toth art is really great, but that's where that one came from. I don't know where the first one came from.
I wonder if it's Justice League. It looks like it could be the one that was used in the Justice League
Could be.
book. Remember when he gets a new costume in the Justice League Europe era? I'm pretty sure they use this logo, which is basically it's black and yellow, which works for canary yellow, I guess. And it's divided into four quadrants. I guess they go into changing the black and yellow color of the font depending on part of the quadrant it's in. It's got a little black canary zooming up between the R and the Y in the word canary.
I kind of like it. I got, like I said, I have a soft spot for it. I don't know how terribly readable it is. The most effective logo. Modern ones she's had and Birds of Prey and so forth are better logos, but I think it's kind of old style to me. It seems, I don't know, I kind of like it.
I've always found her blonde wig an odd thing. I've always thought, If I was going to make a character called Black Canary, I'd be giving the wig black and the natural hair blonde, personally. I've never kind of gravitated to that aspect of the character. You know, it's like, we can see you coming in the darkness. It's not like she's leaning into her blackness very much.
No, clearly not. I think that's a golden age leftover, so to speak. Nowadays, her hair is just blonde. Not in Longbow Hunter. She was black hair for quite a while, but I think nowadays she is. But I think the wigs are funny. I always imagine, you know, any character with a wig, unless it's like attached to a cowl, like Batwoman. Kate Kane, Batwoman, had short hair, but then her long hair and the Batwoman cowl. I can dig that. But when I was a kid, I was like, how do the wigs stay? Wigs don't stay on. All these acrobatics that these superheroes are doing. I just thought that was funny.
Yeah, she comes back to this look a lot. You know, they've tried to reinvent her costume several times, but this fishnet look has stuck around. Even modern versions of her costume sort of speak this a bit. She's still wearing small jackets and you know, she's... Yeah, very body tight fitting clothes.
Again, the fighting aspect, you can imagine that, but the fishnets are just kind of a funny holdover. It looks good, but now what can you say? Yeah, we open up. We have that little scene with Green Arrow and the crook at the beginning. Then we get her starting to muse about it. It's basically a beanpole of a girl is the way that Mike Vosburgh draws her in pages 2, 3, and 4. All she's trying to do is make her dad happy, which, you know, there's certainly relationships like that, right? I mean, here is the father, the wife is dead, especially this time. I mean, this has got to be like 1940, right? Basically wished he had a son so the son could follow him and his family's legacy into become a police officer. But he's like, hey, I'm a little more progressive. I don't care that, you know, she's just a girl, right? She can be a police officer too. And she faces a lot of trials of people saying, oh, you can't do that. You can do that. She says, sure I can. And she just goes out and does it, which I do like quite a bit.
I think, Paul, that she doesn't resent him for it at all, though. Working with kids and teenagers, parents usually get resented when they get pushing their kids that hard. Yeah. And it's interesting because in the much later Secret Origins story where they bring her back into a relationship with her mother, it's actually her mother that she resents, not her father. Like, right. It's really, whereas here we really see the father that's pushing.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that came along when they changed it to be two different women. Post-crisis, she just became her daughter, right? So then that dynamic changed. It became much more onto her mother. And even the recent miniseries, she was antagonistic with her mother.
The other thing that's missing is the whole Wildcat, Ted Grant element to her training.
Yep, that was later too. But I like the sequence when her dad and Lance go in to break up the ring. We get a silent sequence. And I do think this page was very effective by the artists on page 6 into 7, yep, where the two men go in to break it up. Dinah jumps up onto the awning of the building and sneaks in the other way and ends up sneaking around behind the bad guys and taking them out and saving their lives. So I thought that was a pretty good sequence. Exciting, interesting. She got something to go. She looks good in her, not really pink, I don't know, it's kind of a light red suit on that with a tie and a vest, you know, sort of man's clothes, but tapered to a woman's figure. And she's able to take these guys out. And that's when her romance with Larry starts. I like that sequence. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah.
Narratively and art-wise.
Really good storytelling by the artist. I didn't love the bit that preceded it quite as much where they show her growing up from that beanpole girl. The adolescent move towards maturity, always studying and training. I'm kind of like, okay. It's like, and then they dress her in a suit. It's like they're trying to be progressive, but they're not quite there yet.
Yeah,
it's
like, well, you know, he was trying, right?
He's certainly a kick-ass sort of character, the way she's throwing those punches and kicks around.
So then we get the tragic part where she walks in. The father's received a telegram or the letter that says she was rejected and he dies from sadness. To the funeral, she's like, you know what? I'm going to do something different. I thought this was clever. She tells Larry, forget about it. You know, that was his dream. I'm going to open a flower shop. Meanwhile, she's reading newspapers about Batman and the other superheroes. And these are their two versions, of course. And that's when she becomes the Black Canary. I did like that. One of the things I did want to point out, I thought was interesting. Page 9, the panel where the father is, you see him having suffered his heart attack. She's explaining to Larry on the way in. She says, according to Dad, a Drake has even served in the original London police under the Bow Street Runners under John Fielding back in the 1750s. So she's talking about how long her family has been police officers. And that's a real thing. So I looked it up on Wikipedia.
Wow.
The Bow Street Runners were the law enforcement officers of the Bow Street Magistrates Court in the city of Westminster. They have been called London's first professional professional police force. The force originally numbered 6 men and was founded in 1749 by Magistrate Henry Fielding. He's well known. His assistant, brother, and successor as Magistrate John Fielding, who Diana remarks about, molded the constables into a professional and effective force. The Bow Street Runners was the public nickname for the officers, although the officers did not use the term themselves, considered it derogatory. The group was disbanded in 1839, and its personnel merged with the Metropolitan Police of London, which had been formed 10 years earlier. I thought that was really cool.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, what an interesting reference. I wonder if there really was a Drake in that group.
Oh, that'd be cool. That'd be even cooler.
Me too, right? Yeah, really nice history. And look, these comics of this era were a little bit, there were lessons in them.
Like, oh, yeah, it's just, absolutely. I love that stuff.
Like, and then, you know, put a bit of history in. And, you know, the previous one with Orion and Light Ray, it was a bit of a cautionary tale. You know, it's kind of like the stuff that's more common. I really like the scene at the funeral, which is no word balloons at all, but really carries a lot of gravitas for the funeral. I think the poses of the characters is really good.
Then we get to Paige, where she's working on her costume, a tiny bit of a little more cheesecake. But then she joins the Justice Society first, then she gets married, and we see the various other members of the Justice Society that have attended the wedding in their civilian identities, which is kind of fun. And then we get the scene from the issues of the Justice League that you talked about, where Larry is killed. And then she says, you know, hey, I got a new life now. This is my life. I wouldn't have it that other way. I felt that this was the most sort of start to finish complete story. We get a whole story here.
Yep.
It doesn't make sense in terms of the timeline. Even in 1970, this is a woman that, let's say she was 20 when she debuted in 1947 or 48. This is 30 years after that. And even if you say, oh, okay, Green Arrow is a little older, then it still doesn't work, right? Which is why even a few years later, Jerry Conway decides, yeah, we got to do something about that and came up with that other crazy idea. So anyway, I liked it. I did enjoy it.
Definitely a crazy idea. And it's kind of a bit of a link to the Dr. Fate story, you know, of Naboo taking over Kent's mind in a way. And, you know, in that JLA 220, kind of like, you know, let's just take her body. Let's take my daughter's body and just keep living.
And I'll just live in it. Yeah, it's just weird.
Interesting workaround for the story. But
yeah. So I'm going to do a little mini bio here on Mike Vosburgh. I thought it'd be interesting. He's still with us today. He's got his own website called vosart.com. And he had his little bio in his own words. I thought I'd just read that. He says, born in the cold and gloomy confines of Michigan, fantasy and escapism were a natural retreat for Mike. Comics of all sorts, westerns, funny animal, horror, and even costumed heroes were his introduction to literature and art. He soon moved up to illustrations of N.C. Wyeth and the stories of Sax Rohmer, Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and The Twilight Zone, and anything else that caused a chill to run down his spine. While his mom had banned TV from the household, there were weekly trips to the movies, usually with a bag of his dad's homemade popcorn. Bob Hope, Randolph Scott, Danny Kaye, and occasionally some bit of brilliance from Hitchcock filled his life. All of this was a drug that lifted him above the mundane experiences of his life. Storytelling was a religion, and Mike wanted to be a high priest. While he had virtually no formal art training, Mike did have several jobs that helped him prepare for a career in art. As a library page, he learned how to do research. As a worker on the line in a bus factory, he learned how to assemble and put together a project. And as a school teacher, there you go, he learned how to educate both himself and his clients. And as a basketball coach, he learned about team play. And as a janitor, he leaned to clean up after somebody else. As a teenager, Mike edited and produced the fanzine Masquerader, which introduced him to many of his cohorts in the comic book world and helped jumpstart his career. He worked for Marvel and DC for a number of years until moving to LA in the mid-80s, where he branched out into fields of animation, advertising, and film. He's produced artwork for the LA Museum of Tolerance, has drawn the entire run of cover inserts for the HBO Tales from the Crypt series. I didn't know that. I thought that was neat.
Wow.
So they always had like a little cover of a comic book kind of thing. He drew all those, which is neat. And he won an Emmy as a director on the HBO animated series Spawn. Besides any number of advertising projects, he has done storyboards for a number of music videos for the likes of Eminem, Marilyn Manson, and Gwen Stefani. Most recently, Mike has storyboarded The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Prince Caspian, Voyage of the Down Treader, and Journey to the Center of the Earth. In his spare time, Vaz continues to attempt his pursuit of excellence by attending weekly figure drawing workshops and still doing life drawing exercises to this day. I love that. Here's somebody who's, I think, in his early 70s, who's still trying to learn. That I do like. Vaz now concentrates on continuing to produce his own comic book creations, which include the Laurie Lovecraft Omnibus, the Retrowood Omnibus, and the soon-to-be-released Voodoo Mansion Omnibus. Those are all creator-owned projects that he has listed on his website. His beautiful wife, Anna, has moved on from designing jewelry to now creating works of abstract art. They share a studio space where they are watched over by the magnificent three-legged feline Sarah Bernhardt. According to Mike's Amazing World, Mike had 186 mainstream comic story credits with over 3,500 pages and about 100 covers from 1974 to about 1994 when he stopped doing comic work. A lot of them were female characters, given his style and the time. You mentioned that, right? Interior and cover art for DC's Isis and Starfire, the 70s one, She-Hulk, Cloak and Dagger, and G.I. Joe for Marvel, and a run of Howard Chaykin's American Flag, the second series. I remember that. I really liked American Flag when that was out in the 80s, and then when Chaykin brought it back after it stopped the first run, and Vossberg did the art for the second series. He also did a lot of work for Valiant in the early 90s, Archer and Armstrong, Bloodshot, titles like that. So his website is pretty cool. I'll include a link. It's neat because you've got this gallery where he's got some original art. He's got what he says, Vaz Comics. These are his creator-owned. I'd never heard of the character Lloyd Lovecraft. Sounds like a sexy magician kind of thing. Retro Wood, which looks like some sort of gangster thing. And then he's got this Vaz Words, which is his blog. It's interesting. He's got it organized by topic, like Sherlock Holmes and Will Eisner and so forth. And then he has real art, which I thought was neat. He's got a whole bunch of portraits of classic movie stars like Sean Connery, Betty Davis, Audrey Hepburn, Godfather Pacino, Boris Karloff, John Hamm from Mad Men is a more recent one, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. So just kind of a neat website. So I encourage you all to check it out.
It's a new one for me, Paul, as well. So yeah, really cool. Definitely working on the female form seems to be his forte.
Definitely. Not as over the top as some other of his contemporaries, yeah. Of course. But so we're not quite done. We do have one more page, a letters page. And it's really neat. It has three letters corresponding about DC Superstars number 17, which had the debut of the Huntress, as well as Secret Origins for Green Arrow and the Legions. DC Superstars was no longer running at this time. They transitioned to DC Special Series. Ines and Bridwell wrote the letters page. The first one, Rick Taylor, said that it was really a tearjerker. So I like that one. And the costume was va-va-va-boom, the Huntress's costume, which is pretty funny. Can't wait
it
to see
it. It was a good costume.
It is a good costume. The funniest letter was from Jerry Bales, who is, of course, the famous contemporary of Roy Thomas, who was the big Golden Age fan, who was one of the first fanzine type. He did not care for it at all. I'm going to read this whole letter. It's only a paragraph. Says, thanks for sending me the origin of the Huntress. I'd like to comment, but would have to be critical. I'm afraid Batman takeoffs have been overdone. Two Robins. I had to think about that for a second. He meant the Earth 1 and Earth 2. There was no Tim Drake yet.
Not yet.
Two Robins, a Batwoman, Batgirl, son of Batman and World's Finest, Man-Bat, and now the Huntress. It's a cliche. The Huntress is not enough different from Batgirl to warrant its creation. I think he missed the point that she was Earth 2's Batgirl, but, you know, yeah. Okay. Further, Catwoman's motivation was straight out of soap opera. Unacceptable. Sorry, she'll have to be changed substantially for us to like her. Like, whoa, that was rough. I wonder what do you think of today, right? Just wait till
plenty
today.
Of change in the late 80s.
So I thought that's funny. And Ian B does point out, says, you know, Jerry, who's probably the world's number one JSA fan, seems to be the only fan who's to send in a total pan. Despite an occasional criticism, the vast majority loved the Huntress. And then the last letter from Philip Bostwinick has this long explanation. There was this back and forth with him and E. Nelson Bridwell about when exactly did Catwoman go good versus what, you know, there's this one story in Batman number 50 from 1954 where she was bad, but she was still good, you know, so they're trying to get around those continuity glitches, which I always find entertaining.
Yeah, very interesting. And trying to locate, yeah, the Earth One, Superman and Batman and Robin into the timeline. Like, when did they come around? Like, we know when the two ones.
Yeah, I thought Earth One started 1954. Everyone was, no, it's 1955, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then the last point I'll make is funny. Sorry, we have no responses on the Green Arrow and Legion tales. There was some, but the Huntress male overpowered the rest. No, that was funny.
That's very funny. So, yeah.
Yeah, I'll, of course, include a scan of the letters page for the gallery.
And is this the first letters page that the book gets, or are there others previous to this one?
I'd have to go back and look. I'm not reading these in order. Most of them have text pages because of various postal regulations and stuff. Whether they were other letters pages, I'm not sure.
It has a logo for the letter column, and the logo is called Original Thinking, and it's sort of relating to the Secret Origins issue. I don't know if that's the first origin of the Legion of Superheroes, that issue. I know it was not told in great detail. Like there's always the, they come back to Smallville and pick up Superboy. That part's retold a lot. I'd have to talk to some of my other fellow podcasters about that. I haven't read Legion that long.
Yeah, the Legion's been, what, around since 1960 or so, right?
In 1958, 59.
58, 59, just shy of 20 years at this point. Yeah, maybe.
But I like the fact they've gone to the effort of making a logo for the letter column. And that's why I'm wondering if it's the first one and whether that sticks around. It'd be interesting to see as you cover other issues.
We'll get to that's an oft requested one, the first appearance of the Huntress. Not sure when I'll get to that one. All right. Well, that's about it for this comic. So, Brent, what do you think? Did this comic live up to its special billing?
I think it does. I think you've got three really strong stories here. I clearly liked the Light Ray one and the Dr. Fate one a bit more. I think as a person buying this comic back in the day, you would have really enjoyed this comic. And I think there's lots of new in it. You might go and pick up New Gods after reading this, or
Right.
you might be interested in the JSA. I think, yeah, I definitely think it lives up to its special billing.
Yeah, this is definitely worth the 60 cents that it cost. Secret Origins are always fun. Originally, I was going to kind of stay away from them for a while because of the coverage we've had on the network in the past. But hey, the listeners spoke and chose this one, and I wanted to honor that. And this is a great comic, so there's nothing wrong with talking about it. Anyway, thank you, Brent, for joining me. I really appreciate it. Could you give our listeners a taste of what you're working on, your podcast, where they can find you or follow you on the social media sites?
Yeah, I've got a main podcast. You can hear me almost weekly on the Tomorrow's Heroes Today podcast, which is part of the Legion of Substitute Podcasters feed. I also have been on a few other podcasts recently. I've been involved in the Opal City Confidential podcast. I'm doing some things around Starboy, the character in that one. So I'll be in and out of that one a little bit. I've also been involved in Who's Editing. I did an episode of that, which was a lot of fun with Siskoid. And you can also find me on X and Blue Sky as Brento3000.
Well, thanks again, Brent. I'm going to now play a short promo, and when I return, I will read and respond to your listener feedback.
Tomorrow's Heroes Today. Substitute podcasters from the future explore the Wade Kitson Legion.
Brent,
And Derek.
take an in-depth look at the Legion of Superheroes Volume 5, starting with Teenage Revolution.
Welcome back. First up, we've got our next episode announcement. In our October episode, we will have a seasonal Halloween-inspired show. My guest host is not from the House of Mystery or even the House of Secrets, but instead the House of Frankenstein. That's right, Chris Franklin will be on, and we will be covering DC Special Series number 7 from 1977, Ghosts. So look for it on Sunday, October 5th. Now, let's get to your comments about DC Special Cast number 8. Enemy Ace, with my friend Ace, guest star Captain Entropy. First up, I actually got a text message from my dad, who does graciously listen to the show, even though he doesn't have much interest in comic books. He's a history buff, though, and he had this to say. Hi, Paul. I just listened to your latest podcast. It was terrific. I really enjoyed it. I liked all the research that went into both you and your guest's comments, and I actually learned quite a bit from it. It was great. Thanks, Dad. I also got an email from Peter Watson of the Earth 2 podcast, who will be a future guest on the show. That's a great podcast if you haven't checked it out. Peter had this to say. I just finished listening to today's episode and I really enjoyed it. Some great insights there. That enemy Ace story you mentioned at the start, where the dog he adopts, which falls out of his plane, annoys me so much. He has a dog loose in his cockpit? What does he expect to happen? Grr. Anyway, looking forward to next month's episode. I know, Peter, right? I haven't read that story, and although I'm not really a pet guy, I don't think I want to read that story. And then on Facebook, we got a nice compliment from John Stibe, who reposted our show announcement and said, as a kid, I never understood Enemy Ace, or if I was supposed to be rooting for him or for the other guys. Even his name confused me. But check out this episode of one of my favorite podcasts to learn more about the man known as the Hammer from Hell. Thanks, John. It was really nice of you. Appreciate it. So now let's get to your comments from our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. That's the best place to go to be sure we don't miss them. First up, we got Rob McCarthy. He said, somehow every Sergeant Rock comic I ever read had Enemy Ace in the back. You'd think I hope he never became a Nazi. But Danny Rob goes on to say, can I say that Who Killed Batman was a really dumb story? If Lex Luthor had ever punched Batman, he'd feel the difference in hitting somebody as opposed to Superman. I can't say I agree with you there, Rob. I love that storyline when I was a kid. Doesn't hold up the best today, but it's still, I do love it. Kevin from New Orleans responded to his first part of his comment. He said, the Garth Ennis Russ Heath two-part miniseries War in Heaven, set in World War II, addresses if he became a Nazi. That's an incredible story. Yeah, Captain Entropy mentioned that one, Kevin. I haven't read it, but if I see it, I might pick it up. Kevin goes on, and he says, if anyone wants to read an awesome story with Enemy Ace in it, pick up Saga of the Swamp Thing number 83. After reading that, I was a fan, and I got his first appearance at a traveling flea market 30 years ago and grabbed any books he guest starred in, plus the archive edition for him and the DC direct action figure. So Kevin's a big Enemy Ace fan, so that's really cool, Kevin. Thanks for the tips and your insights. My pal Dan wrote, great stuff and research all around. I've had the showcase issue of Enemy Ace in my collection for decades, but somehow I've never read it or any other Enemy Ace, so I learned so much over the past hour. I also happen to have this issue of DC Special, so I was able to read it today before listening, which made your cast even more enjoyable. I liked having Captain Entropy on, providing the military aviation aspects. Thanks, Dan. Here's a question, though, from Dan. He says, I noticed in one story there's a third of the page of a house ad at the bottom of the page on the left side of the comic fold, despite the fact that the story continues directly on the page to the right, with no page flipping needed. They nonetheless have story continues on the next following page at the bottom of the panel. I've always assumed that publishers had to put this in the bottom of the page when the next page you turn to would be an ad to separate the content from the ad, sort of a warning to kids that the next page wasn't content. Maybe this was a legal requirement? Does anyone know? Just something I was always curious about. Keep up the good work. It's a good question, Dan. You know, as we all know, that kind of thing was certainly a common practice. Remember, these were reprints, so maybe originally it said story continues on the second following page or third following page, and whoever was statting it up just changed it to next as opposed to trying to wipe the whole thing out. Anyway, Bucky749 is up next. He said, I first met Enemy Ace in the Batman Brave and the Bold cartoon. That's how I met a lot of characters back then. I like the wolf partner, and kind of mad that DC didn't let Enemy Ace keep the small dog he found. I think any hero is better with an animal partner, and I love the idea of his squad having a dog as their mascot. I also believe that there were several heroic dogs in the war in real life. Morgan Butler was next up, and he said, Manfred von Richthofen was the ace known to us as the Red Baron, who Charles Schulz made the nemesis of Snoopy in his World War I fantasies. I know, Morgan, that was so cool. I had never known that before the captain pointed out to me. It's fantastic. Next up, we had Movie Matt Sorois, who said, another great episode. I love this show. Thank you, Matt. We get episodes of strange sports, superheroes and disasters, and World War I combat in the blazing skies. I'm only familiar with Enemy Ace from his feature in the short-lived Men of War comic from the late 70s, and the really fun pulp adventure Guns of the Dragon that you guys mentioned. That's a 4-issue miniseries I highly recommend tracking down. You get an Enemy Ace, Batlash, Vandal Savage, dinosaurs, and ninjas all running wild in search of a legendary pair of swords. Yeah, Matt, that's another one I've never read, and I probably should. Sergeant Rock, codenamed Gravedigger, and the Unknown Soldier were the war comic heroes of my youth. Of course, once Marvel's G.I. Joe hit the stands, featuring high-tech modern-day military force, all other war books were kind of doomed. Sergeant Rock managed a few more years and might have gone on longer had the Schwarzenegger film adaption ever been made. G.I. Joe was a dominating force in toy aisles, comic book racks, and television. Our guest from that very episode, Captain Entropy, piped in. He says, thanks to everybody for the kind words about the show. For the sake of completeness, the fourth force acting on an aircraft in flight, the one I forgot, is weight, caused, of course, by gravity. For another podcast where I talk about a time I forgot about weight and gravity, listen to Shag and me on the JLI podcast. And, of course, he left a helpful link to the show. So thanks, Captain. Another Captain, Super Captain, says, this was a fun episode, even for a non-military, uneasy flyer like me. My first exposure to Enemy Ace was my first Justice League comic, Justice League of America number 159. My original copy is long gone into the mist of time, but I recently picked up another copy of this classic JLA-JSA team-up. And Captain Entropy, I love the idea of hidden treasure comics. Past guest and host of the fantastic podcast, The Fantastic Poor, Brent Young says, great episode, Paul and Cap. Cap really brought the knowledge, and I had to skip back 4 times to understand how wind currents lift an airplane. Spoiler alert, I still don't understand, but that's on me. I'm pretty sure the only time I've read Enemy Ace was in the Best of DC Digest, so it was really interesting learning more about him. Just a great episode. To which Captain Entropy then provided an extensive description and a diagram of the Bernoulli effect, so check them out on the website. You get some more science education. Who says this isn't Age of Information on the Fire and Water Podcast Network? Next up, past guest Dr. Ange said, "Great episode. The cover alone might make it worth the price. I found a copy of the Enemy Ace Archive Edition still in shrink wrap for $20 at a bookstore, and I grabbed it. I love the main character, his conflicted feelings, his honor, his difficulty relating to humans, his bond with a wolf. Will you marry that complexity with Kubert's superior art, from the brooding camp scenes to the incredible aerial battles? This is a big win. The discussion of the parachute was fantastic, too. Great show, as always. Thanks, Ange." Hey, there is a second volume of those archives, just so you know. Brian Schufo's next. He said, "Excellent episode and educational too. Captain Entropy was the perfect co-host for this issue. I never knew what a tracer bullet was beyond an alias used in Calvin and Hobbes." To which the Cap replied, "I loved whenever Calvin and Hobbes went into Calvin's fantasy world, but I especially love the kid noir tales of tracer bullet. And thanks for the kind words." Network co-founder and noted film historian Rob Kelly said, "This was a great episode. Captain Entropy's military knowledge, something pretty rare on our network, brought some real fascinating real-world context to the details of the story. I have not read many Enemy Ace stories, primarily because when I was a kid, biplans equals snore. But now, of course, I have a greater appreciation for the material and the subtlety that the creators were trying to bring to war comics and not have it just be action, action, action. It would be easy to make war comics make it look all fun, which is a disservice to everyone involved." Well said, Rob. Chris Moore said, "Whoa, great episode. I had never even heard of Enemy Ace before, and now I'm on the hunt for anything I can find. The thought of an enemy being the protagonist intrigues me. Thanks for bringing my attention to this great character." Wow, Chris, that's awesome. That kind of thing makes my day. That's the reason we're doing this show, to bring to light some things people might not know about. So that's great. Thanks, Chris, for sharing. Next month's guest, Chris Franklin from the House of Frankenstein, says, "Fantastic and very educational discussion, Paul and Captain. I first met Enemy Ace, kinda, in the Tempo Batman paperback from the 70s, which reprinted the O'Neill Adams' Ghost of the Killer Skies stories with Batman and, quote, Enemy Ace, or a reasonable facsimile. I honestly haven't read many of his stories, but the one that stands out to me was the short Silent Tale in Christmas with the Superheroes number 2 by John Byrne, doing his best Kubert impersonation. It captured the character really well, methinks. I applaud DC for recognizing quality work like this and giving a spotlight when it wasn't terribly commercially viable at the time. It would have been easier just to put out another Superman or Batman reprint title to take up shelf space and appease advertisers, but they did something more here. Books like this were the road to the modern trade paperback. I'm so glad they are getting such a great showcase here on Paul's show. If I ever see this book with its gorgeous cover at a reasonable price, I'm definitely going to pick it up. And yes, we need more DC War Comics on the DCU Infinite app." Thanks, Chris. Thanks for those kind words. Next up, our pal Ward Hill Terry says, "Enemy Ace was a character I started collecting near the end of my collecting days. I met George Pratt at a con when he was working on his Enemy Ace book. I chatted with him about the project, and his enthusiasm for the character infected me. I bought a sketch of Enemy Ace from him and a non-Enemy Ace print as well. For the next couple years, when I had occasion to be in a comic shop, I hunted for affordable issues of Star Spangled War or Unknown Soldiers that had Enemy Ace in them. This was many years after the special discussed on this podcast. When this book had come out, I had no interest in it at all. However, I do have the original printing of the first story in the special, so I was able to read along. There's a bit of a repetition to Enemy Ace stories. One reads about Spads and Newports and Fokkers and Camels, the Curse of the Skies, the isolation of Von Hammer, and of course, the inevitability of death. But each story on its own, especially when drawn by Kubert, is a gem." And then Terry brings up a very interesting point that I probably should have mentioned during the show. He says, "This issue may be the last all-reprint comic from DC at that time. When Jeanette Kahn came in and became publisher, she launched a concerted effort to remove all the reprint titles from the roster. This title, like almost all the titles this podcast will examine, had started out as a reprint book. I remember as a young reader then, many letter columns praising the move and scorning reprints in general. I did research on Mike's Amazing World, praise be its existence, and there were a few more titles that had one or two reprints in them over the next few months, but DC Special number 26 seems to be the last book of just reprints. Of course, until DC realized the value of reprints in better packaging, i.e., of course, trade paperbacks and hardcovers." Excellent point, Terry. One of the things I do find fascinating about all this is that migration. I mean, we saw it in Batman Family. We saw it in a bunch of other books at the time. So yeah, good point. Thanks for bringing that up. Future guest Martin Gray says, "The Enemy Ace comics I've read are the same as those that Chris cites, so I found this show very BBC, informative, educational, and entertaining. I wonder if there were any prototype Enemy Ace in DC Comics, given how often a character would appear and die in one-off tale before a very similar character was given a series." That's an excellent question, Martin. That's what happened to Sergeant Rock, so that's pretty cool. Maybe Robert Kaniger had another sympathetic German before Von Hammer appeared. The only other German protagonist comic I'm aware of is that Blitzkrieg comic, 5 issues or whatever it was. Back to Martin. Anyway, cheers, Chaps, Paul is indeed a great host, thank you. And Captain Entropy was the expert fan we needed for the show. And we finish up with Doug Adamson, gets his comment in just under the wire. And he says, if there's one man I trust to give us a podcast episode about NMEAs, it's the good Captain Entropy. This was inspired co-hosting choice by Paul and excellent lobbying by the captain. I love the episode and I came away feeling smarter than I did before I listened. Not sure how you both managed that because I was also thoroughly entertained at the same time. Thank you both for this wonderful hour of listening. Thank you, Doug. That's really kind of you to say. I just want to say thank you, everybody, for these great comments. I wasn't sure. I was really a little nervous about NMEAs to see if people would enjoy it, but I'm really gratified to see that people seem to enjoy the episode, which was a little bit different, obviously, than our usual fare. So thank you. And that's it for the comments. A reminder, if you enjoy what you hear on this show or any of the other network shows, please consider becoming a patron to help defray the costs. At certain levels, you can get a call out on the show of your choice or suggest an episode to the network. To find out how, go to patreon.com/FWPod. Podcasts and thanks. That'll do it for the feedback section and for this episode. My thanks again to Brento3000 for appearing on this episode. It was a ton of fun to record with him, and I hope you all enjoy the show. Thanks for listening, and I hope you will join me next month on DC Special Cast as Chris Franklin and I discuss Ghosts.